Doctor Who fans all over the cosmos. Welcome to another Who Corner to Corner podcast. My name is Paul and I'm with my good friend Jeff, and also you're kind of a regular now, aren't you, I suppose? We are here
third appearance.
Indeed. This is, probably needs no introduction, but I will introduce him anyway. It's Mr. Al Dewar from Character Options. Hello, sir. Good evening. Welcome, and how are you?
Good evening. I'm very good. It's been, I think I was saying earlier, it's been quite a long week, funnily enough.
Which, I mean, it's Thursday.
It's been one of those weeks where there's been quite a lot going on. Yes, I'm very good. I'm reliably informed via text that Ed will be joining us.
Fantastic.
In 5 minutes. Fantastic. Just trailing. I'm good, but tired.
Good, but tired. Well, of course, we had the whole fugitive doctor launch not that long ago. Is that still bubbling away, and you've got lots of other stuff going on as well?
It is. it was. So the whole Fugitive Doctor launch was quite funny, and there's probably a few fans out there angry more than likely.
Surely not. So angry fans? Never.
Yeah.
Never.
So there was a whole, basically they got in touch with our network provider and said, we're launching this new product. It's going to be on this day. The traffic is going to be massively heavy. Can we provide for some extra bandwidth? Blah blah blah. Everything's fine. somehow, somewhere, press release went out to somebody a day early. They didn't look at the date for publication, and they literally, so first day of Toy Fair, they put the announcement live on their site. 24 hours before we were due to go live, so there was like beep 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 beep, so beep. All the emails started rushing in, and yes, so the irony was our website was very much set up to cope with an increased level of traffic, as were the network provider 24 hours later. 4,000 fans plus decided to go online to try and order the set in the first 20 minutes. And as usual,
it kind of
turned into a bit of a debacle, and the whole thing fell over and then relaunched and then fell over and then relaunched and then fell over. So, but yes, I would say in general, I don't think that was necessarily a bad thing, by the way, because I think what tended to happen was I think people gave up literally after a small amount of time. I thought, sod this, I'll go and have a cup of tea, I'll come back later. So it became a little bit more civilized and a little bit
kind
more
kind of settled
steady.
Down a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. As the day and days went on. So I think we're now officially sold out, or at least we're down to the last 250 pieces, which we keep in reserve for returns or
that's
anything
pretty good.
General.
Excellent. And it was an online exclusive as well, wasn't it? So it wasn't in the shops or anything. The only way people could buy it was via the website.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And that was always the intention with this one. We obviously do a bunch of product through B&M that sort of reduced this year in terms of what we're offering through B&M. And I think it's fair to say ahead of time it will reduce again this year. And what you'll sort of begin to see, hopefully, there's definitely a bubbling under and a massive interest in Doctor Who. I think what you'll see this year is quite a few exclusives coming online, and then shortly thereafter there will be what you would call more standard retail options. Right. And that, I think, is great, because that means that your everyday retailer is actually starting to get interested in Doctor Who. And to that very point, this week we had Sonic Screwdrivers back in Argos for the first time.
Yes.
Cool. Yeah.
So, you know, long may it continue. But it's good. I think it's indicative of, the feeling everyone has that something this time around is different.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, the launch for the Fugitive Iggy, I was taken by surprise, as I'm sure you were as well, because I had the email and we'd been talking about, you know, this is when it's launching and everything, and then it was suddenly revealed properly. You know, it went out the day before, because I was thinking, oh, I'm in the office on the Tuesday, so I'll be able to put out our chat with Al, and you know, we'll wait till the official announcement, and you know. So fine, if, you know, depending on when it goes out, I'll be there and, you know, can handle it all and everything. And then it went out on Monday morning, and I was like, oh God, I wasn't expecting that at all. And, you know, we'll see, like, that's a minor problem, you know. And you know, so I can see why, yeah, it wasn't ready for it when it went out early like that. So, but it's a great sign that, you know, it did so well.
Yeah, and it was, you know, it was a great set. It was, you know, there's so many different things this time round. I mean, there was a few false starts, and you know, we can talk about that. But what I would say is, you know, just we had, you know, at the day when we did the filming with Joe Martin, we had Jeff who came along.
I wasn't jealous at all, by the way. It's fine. I'm not jealous that Jeff was invited and went along and got to meet her and everything. I'm okay with that. Just putting that out there.
Well, but what was really weird was I think I WhatsApped you. Yeah. The probably something like the Friday, and we were filming on the Monday, and I had it in my head, oh, I'll just record this on my iPad, and I was suddenly like, this is going to be horrendous if I do this on my iPad. People are going to just, you know, they'll be taken back to that sweaty moment in the pub where I'm trying to in the beer garden.
That moment.
I was like, geez, I can't. So I literally got in contact with Jeff, and so I've said, there's no chance you're not busy. I just made the assumption you weren't busy, Jeff, next week. And
slammed you by the pool drinking martinis.
Yeah.
And then, bless him, he turned up looking so professional. Yeah. It was amazing. And then, you know,
it was a beautiful sight.
He is a beautiful sight. So you've got talent there and, you know, everything. Hi, Ed. I haven't seen you for 6 million years.
Good evening.
Fantastic. No, it's good to see you both, gents. It's we were just talking, Ed, just before we jumped on, about the filming of Joe Martin with the reveal when Jeff Solo was invited by Al along to the BBC. So you were originally going to do it on your iPad. That was your thought. And then you got Jeff to turn up with his kit, and he looks all professional, and he had his bags. And
yes. I mean, that was it. I mean, bless him. I turned up, Joe turned up, and then Jeff said, oh, I'm at the side of the building. And I went, oh, okay. So I wandered around the side, and here he is with a bag of, he's a bit like Ed, like that. He always carries that air of, I know what the hell I'm doing.
Yeah, he does actually. Yeah.
Which is great, because
it's quite impressive.
I'm looking for someone called Ed.
I immediately sort of said,
is he coming later?
Yeah, this is Jeff. He'll be our.
No, he would have been on time.
That's not a dig at me for last week, is it, Ed?
No.
I missed the entire podcast.
I think absence is there's something stylish about that. Right?
Well, just not showing up at all. Yeah.
Turning up fashionably late and then it's just not turning up, which
is even cooler. Yeah, I texted you, didn't I, Al? I said, I'm here, where are you? And you said, I'm around the corner, I'm holding a large cardboard box. And I thought, you're probably the only person who's going to be holding that. But I was picturing, like, not being able to see you behind it. So,
yes.
Is it, Al,
this is a question from Boomerang on Gallifrey Base. And they ask, what is your day-to-day work character like? Is there such a thing as a regular day?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, like most people's jobs these days, I would say 75% of it is actually less now. So let's say 50% of it's emails. We use Teams now quite a lot for stuff in terms of sharing thoughts and ideas and who's buying the biscuits. So it's and that's quite a powerful tool. I find it a little bit clunky, but it's pretty cool. So my typical day would be, we have probably three to four. We have probably three big active projects at any one time, and that's not Doctor Who. And I'm just saying it straight. So it's not Doctor Who. So three to four, and by big I mean they're big chunky development items. We've then probably got at least two or three sort of conceptual ones that are coming through. We're at an interesting point in the year now where we're kind of finishing up 1 year's development, and we're, I would say, 25% into the new year's development. So it's a lot of communication at the end of the day, as you might imagine. It's a lot of getting up, speaking to people. We liaise with our engineering group in the Far East. We're getting CAD sent to us to look at and comment on. With the CAD, so just so that everyone knows, so CAD is kind of exactly what Ed does. So it's where he's digital sculpting. This is digital engineering of plastics and how things are going to go together. So an example would be the sonic screwdriver. So we'll get CAD in, which has been engineered, but obviously there's always an aesthetic take on that. A lot of my time is looking at stuff and annotating it, because I find that quite easy to do. So I sketch over stuff and draw what I want it to look like. But we do everything. I mean, we do... Okay, so as an example, today I was looking at some models of a new project that's going through. So these are actual models that have been made in the Far East. I was also writing instructions for a product that's very near the end of its gestation. So I was literally writing the instructions. I was writing a Doctor Who press release. I was looking at some samples that came in of a new product that's launching this year, where it's got printed surface details, and just really chatting with people about what we... I mean, it was literally, I just got up and we all had a little vote about which characters we thought were cute and what colours worked and what didn't. So, yeah, so, I mean, it's a real mixed bag in terms of the day-to-day...
Mm. It's quite varied then, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's not just Doctor Who then that you are involved in?
No, Doctor Who. I've always said Doctor Who is actually a relative... And it's not that it's insignificant, and that's people quite often take it as that. Every project is exactly the same importance. They're just all on a timeline, and you have to get them from A to B on a timeline. So I was talking about Doctor Who today. What was I talking about Doctor Who today? So I was sending some paint masters to the Far East. That was yesterday. Today I was, as I say, looking at a press release, and I was looking at some figures.
Mm. I've got some renders for you as well, Al.
Oh, nice. Have you?
I mean, I could share them now.
No, I was going to say, share them, feel free.
I'll just put a lost signal graphic.
Yeah, that's all happening. That's a good point, because Ed's made a relevant point there, which is, as well as all that happening internally, I'm liaising with people outside the company as well, and to people like Ed in terms of stuff I'm asking him to do, so stuff that's being commissioned, illustrations that might be being done for something, mock-ups that might be done for something. So yeah, it is very much a mixed bag, but I mean a big chunk of it is just communication. We so the way the company's set up, we're in the London office. There's a Oldham office, which is marketing, sales and warehousing, and is the bigger chunk of personnel, arguably. And then we have the Far East office, which does the engineering, ordering, logistics, shipping, etc.
Al, I've got a supplementary question.
Go on then.
If it's allowed. It's an intriguing one to me that it's not, I don't think it's one I've asked before, but we've just come off the back of International Toy Fair. Mm. Does that make a big difference to what you do this time of year? Does feedback you get on product lines that you've displayed inform
what happens next, the next run of
ongoing thing?
I would say
I've got another question that I can attach to that, if that's okay. Which came from TL85 on Twitter, who asked, how do things work at Toy Fair? So do are retailers just wandering around to check things out, or and you have to kind of lure them in, or have they made an appointment and that, you know, there's already some interest?
No, there's always an appointment. Toy Fair is essentially a showcase of your products, and it's primarily aimed at retailers. So what you're doing is you're getting your Tesco's, your Argos's, your Smith's toys. They've seen previews of what you're intending to show them and sell to them all along the way. But Toy Fair is essentially a showcase where you're showing them something that's very close to being completed.
Right.
There is still an opportunity to change something. So if they see something and they go, this is really lovely, but there's still a chance to do it. So Toy Fair, it's a showcase of the new products you're developing. It's a showcase of third-party products that you're distributing from other people. And it's, in regard to things like Doctor Who, it's basically a message of intent. You're going to show them something. Yeah.
This is where we're going for this year, this next 12 months or so.
Nothing is necessarily set in stone, but I mean, some things are, but some things aren't. So, you know, a good example would be, some of the action figures that we would show and things like the Sonic.
Yeah.
So they're, you know, very much.
So back to what Ed was asking then, presumably then with all activity, all those meetings with retailers, all those kind of forecasting plans and sales figures and everything else, does that have quite a big impact then on what happens for the rest of that year?
Well, like I say, it's a showcase, and essentially the retailers are there to basically say, yes, we're still interested in this product and we think we'll order X, Y, and Z. I mean, to be honest, there's been meetings happening all year, which, as I say, that happens in the Northern office primarily. We're not privy to. Orders are essentially in and on the books. It's almost like a sort of last chance for retailers to kind of see stuff and kind of think, oh, actually, maybe we should be upping the, you know, because all the way through, in terms of stuff you're showing to other people, you're essential. The more stuff you show to people, the more you generate interest, and interest translates into orders. And if suddenly something is bucking the trend and there's a lot of interest in it, then it's a point where you can say to the retailer, are you sure you don't want to be part of this? Because these guys guys are in, and we're going to, you know, it's big, you know. So it's not heavy handed, but it's, I mean, most toy fairs are just a showcase. It's a way to say, look how wonderful we are. This is what we're doing. And kind of show off all the hard work. And it was good this year, because I would say for the first time in a, I think it's safe to say, you know, first time in a long time, the amount of product that we were creating was probably bigger and more front and center than third party stuff.
That's pretty good then, isn't it?
Hasn't been there, you know, hasn't been like that for a while. So
yeah,
it was a good one. It was a good toy fair. So obviously there, some images leaked out and stuff.
Yeah, so was the feedback from retailers pretty positive then? So, because obviously it's been quite a difficult few years, and, you know, retail isn't really set to pick up.
It's horrible. It's absolutely horrible out there. But actually, it seems to be very much. I mean, it was interesting for me, because there was a lot of people that came back to our stand and said, "Bloody hell, you guys are the only guys that are really doing stuff that's new." Interesting and different, because everybody else is kind of playing it safe. And that's the kind of message you want, and that's good to hear, because, you know, as I say, if you're the one that's the standout, you know, people
for the right reasons,
that's sort of people are kind of talking about and sort of going, oh, you know, this is different, this is new. So it does seem to be a bit like that there's not a lot of investment, that people are kind of refreshing what they've already got, whereas we actually did have quite a lot of new stuff to show.
And that's across everything that you make, not just the Doctor Who stuff.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, if you'd been at a toy fair, and it was a shame you guys didn't get down there, and not everybody does. It's Doctor Who was literally in a sort of cabinet. I mean, we were
proudly showing it off.
Yeah. It was in a cabinet, and it's you know, like any company, we have lots of eggs in lots of baskets, and that's not to diminish Doctor Who at all. It's just literally Doctor Who is part of everything.
Yeah, it's one part of many different things involved in. Yeah.
And I think that's the popular misconception is Algier is in charge of Doctor Who. He eats, sleeps, and drinks it. I absolutely don't. Yeah. It's,
and the website. Yeah, yeah.
And our website as well.
Yeah.
Oh, and the website. Website. Well, I was explaining about the website. Yeah, you know, there was a reason for the website.
Yeah, it's because you
website was all set to handle everything, Ed, until somebody let it release 24 hours early, and then the entire thing fell over as normal.
Crazy.
So, we had a couple of questions about underground toys. Now, I didn't really know kind of what that was, but so the question was
a new one on me, Jeff.
People wondered what happened there, and if you could tell us anything about
it. Like trains, and, subway trains, stuff like that.
Actually, I can't. I can't discuss that one in any detail. I can give you a potted history. So, I think around 2010, 2011, it's earlier than that. 2008, probably 2009. There was a company based in London that had a US arm. And that was a partnership, but essentially they traded under the same name, which was Underground Toys. We had a partnership deal with them specifically on Doctor Who, whereby they distributed a bunch of our stuff and we co-developed a bunch of stuff with them. And long story short, that was successful for a long time, and then eventually the relationship didn't work anymore, and everybody went their separate ways, and the US arm became a different entity. But I can't talk details on that one because it's
that's fair enough. There was a question from Miles here, Miles Mysterio 03.
Well, I like that.
That's a good one.
He said, at least he didn't have an underscore. I love names with loads of underscores on Twitter. He heard of 5 underground items in, it must have been 2016. 2 were 12th Doctors in hoodies, 10 in a tuxedo, and a TARDIS playset. But he wondered if you knew what the 5th item was. It was never revealed, and he was intrigued.
Give me those again, because I'm not 100% sure even that's correct.
Oh, really? So
far away.
Two 12th Doctors in hoodies, so I guess variants, a 10th Doctor in his tux, and a TARDIS playset. I think maybe a...
So, yeah, we did do 12th Doctor in the hoodie 5-inch figure variant, and that was done... We had lots of... I think Ed will remember. We had like a spotty shirt and a various other. Yeah. But yes, so we did have that. The other one was
10 in a tux.
Yeah,
10 in a tux. That was definitely done as the Wii. Eventually, I think released that in the UK. So that was done in a wave of figures that was released specifically for the US, which did cause a lot of angst because they got things like a Black Dalek sec that had been produced in the sort of correct body shape proportions. The TARDIS console room, I don't remember that at all. There was never any console rooms discussed. There is CAD for a 11th Doctor console room set, but that was developed for the 3.75-inch figures,
right?
And I can't think what the other one would have been.
Maybe
so. I'm sorry, Miles.
Yeah, we'll have to leave him. That's a long lost Mysterio figure. I shall
punish myself accordingly for not knowing the answer. That was weird because that was a bit of a mixed bag of stuff I know was released, I know was never going to be released and was a different scale and various other things. So, yeah.
So interesting. We had a lot of questions about B&M. If we can,
yeah, I'm just
move
looking at those.
That for a
minute. Mm, quite a few.
Yeah, there was a
set
lot.
Set yourself
yeah.
down for this, guys. Hot okay. topic.
I'm crazy.
So, people wondered what the setup was there. Obviously, you know, say what you can. People were saying, you know, it's hard to get figures, and you know, some stores never have any. Scalpers get hold of them, and so they kind of wondered how the deal with B&M came about, and you know,
could it be picked
probably
up by somebody else, or yeah, that sort of thing.
So this is a double-edged sword, in sort of sorts for the fans. So on one hand, I think the fans can or should.
No, have we lost him? Oh no, you're there.
Again. Sorry, you left us on a massive cliffhanger there.
That was huge.
on one hand, I think the fans owe B&M a massive thank you because they have single-handedly kept the Doctor Who range alive for the best part of 10 years. And anybody who decries B&M and tries to say that that's not the case is talking rubbish. I mean, B&M have kept... Now, don't get me wrong, and that's the other side of the case. B&M have their own reasons for Doctor Who, and they use it as a bit of a tool to generate... Footfall around the stores and stuff like that.
Which most retailers would do, right? It's a popular line.
But they've been
attracts people in.
Yeah.
Get it in. And they're exclusive.
They've been very loyal. So the flip side is B&M started, this is trouble, people forget. So B&M started basically with Doctor Who on the basis that they would take old figures that had already been made, and they would be re-released back into the community, rehabilitated.
Beautiful.
And basically, that was it. Yeah. It was literally like, we've done these, we'll re-release them. We've done these, we'll re-release them. And that trotted along quite nicely in exactly that format for about 3 years. And then they sort of said, oh, yeah, we'd love to do more.
Yeah.
But we've had this. You know, you started to get the old things that we've had Cybermen. Mm. We've had this. We've had Angels. We've had this person. We've had that. So we got to the point where we're sort of saying, well, maybe we can do variants and sort of be a bit more creative. And that eventually escalated to the point where we were essentially doing a bit of development each year to kind of create a new B&M line, which is fine in principle. But the honest answer is... the investment to get figures made is humongous. So you're in a slightly tricky situation where your hands are a little bit tied by the fact that you don't really have a lot of money to spend, because obviously essentially what you're buying from B&M is three action figures fully decorated 6-inch that work out or nowadays around nowadays it's around a tenner each, but in the old days, it was about £7.45 each. You can't walk into any shop in the UK, literally no shop in the planet, and buy three highly decorated 6-inch articulated action figures for that kind of money, for a tenner.
I said that last time.
Anybody that says, Hasbro can do it, they don't. If you look at what Hasbro do, there's not very much decoration. It's all molded in color, and they're clever about
the
what they do. But you go and buy a Black Series figure, which is the nearest equivalent. And I'm not claiming, by the way, before anybody jumps down, that what we're producing is Black Series class figures. Yeah. But you're paying £24 up for a Black Series 6-inch figure, and you're basically paying under a tenner for a B&M figure. So, you know, there isn't really the room there for, you know, heavy investment. So there's always been a slight angst that every year the fans want kind of something new and something different. But honestly, the development money isn't always there. On top of that, the other thing in terms of distribution is it's nothing to do with us. We make it for B&M. We ship it from China direct to their factories. Direct to their warehouses. They distribute it.
Yeah.
I mean, I can moan about, and I do, about how they distribute it, how they, what seems to be going on.
They'll have like, well, they do, don't they? They have distribution centres up and down the country, and those distribution centres will serve a satellite of stores. But each of those stores will be kind of tiered in terms of its kind of sales figures and foot traffic, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, these are our tier one stores. They're the ones that everybody goes to. They've got massive footfall, making a whole load of profit, bringing in money. These are our lower tier stores. They're not performing. And each one will have its own kind of merchandising plan, right? Within the tiers, and Doctor Who will not apply to all of those, presumably.
You know, and they're, that's it. And so their distribution is entirely how they want to do it. You know, what has seemed to happen the last couple of years is we ship it to them. We know it's in their warehouse, they will sit on it for a month and a half. But that's B&M. That's up to them.
Yeah.
It's nothing to do with character. With my character head on, rather than anything else, it's nothing to do with character. I mean, I think it was a shame because they announced that they were going to move a lot of the Doctor Who stuff online. And I think for the average collector, that would have been a really cool move.
Mm.
But then it didn't happen. So I think there was that generated a degree of angst. But again, it's not us. And then the flip side of that is look at the character options online thing. Imagine B&M buckling under there's a Dalek, 4,000 people gonna go online. They probably don't want that either, so
no,
you know, you can't win. So yeah, the honest answer is brilliant relationship with B&M. They've supported us every year. We've supported them. We've always tried to do new product. We try and be innovative with a very, very small budget. I think for the most part, it's worked. Sometimes it hasn't worked particularly well. Ed's been a big part of that. He's had massive input in terms of the small little changes and heads and stuff that we've done. So complete kudos to him on that. And that's about it. It's just they are a customer. And we don't have any control over what they do with their products. Mm. And to be honest, we shouldn't. It's nothing to do with us.
You distribute it to them, and then, like you said, it's kind of out of your hands then at that point. And, you know, I think Paul's exactly right. You know, they'll have their, you know, the hub in each area and the stores around it, and it'll all be kind of dished out depending on how popular a store is, essentially.
And one of the unfortunate things was that they moved from taking an assortment, which is basically when a carton is filled with half of the Daleks and half blah blah blah, to basically taking solids. And I think that had the knock-on effect that one B&M could end up with Planet of the Daleks, and the other B&M could end up with Dalek Invasion of Earth, whatever it was, just because by dint of the fact that it's now not an assortment, it's a solid.
So the case has one specific range, and another case has another. No, they're not mixed cases, like that kind of thing.
And like you said, they've kept the line going.
Well, they have, haven't they?
Through that partnership, you know, and but I think, you know, we should be, you know, grateful for that, and that there is, you know, would it be fair to say there could easily be nothing or next to nothing as the alternative?
Yes, I think it is, and that's why I say I think fans are. I get it on one hand, but on the other hand, I think there's a debt of gratitude owed to B&M because for that cabal of X number of Doctor Who fans that have wanted Doctor Who action figures. They've kept it going for, I'm thinking back to 2000. I was looking the other day. I think I had B&M presentation boards going back to like 2011, 2012, and probably earlier. So it's a long time. I mean, it's over a decade that these guys, and consistently, whatever their motives, whatever their reasoning, and I've sat down with the buyers, and it's clear they have no knowledge whatsoever of Doctor Who, or even what it's about.
Oh, really?
But
I thought they must be
fans.
They have continually
bought into the brand and kept that brand going. So, like I say, whatever you say, whatever you got an issue with them being M, you better thank them with one hand and slap them with the other.
It's always a difficult thing with exclusives, though, isn't it? You know, because on the one hand, you've got a retail store that kind of guarantees to sell them, and they're going to guarantee to at least buy off you a specific number of units, right? Which your factory could then make in the knowledge that these are going to be sold through at least to retail stores. And then, but on the other hand, you know, when the lines become a little bit more in demand, perhaps you're like, well, maybe. You know, we're actually restricting our market reach here by doing this. You know, we actually, you know, instead of actually, you know, getting the most out of one particular channel, we're maybe not quite getting what we should out of it. But then on the other hand, like you said, you know, these guys have been loyal. They've been stocking Doctor Who character options when nobody else has, or nobody else has wanted to take the risk of filling, you know, one of their shelf spaces with the stuff, or at least giving you the kind of commitment.
No other retailers wanted it. I mean, we had Sonics figures. No, we had Sonics in a few retailers up until relatively I always think relatively recently, and then I think actually it was 5 years ago. But so things like classic Sonic assortment in a CDU up until relatively recently, but not since then.
Why do you think they didn't want to take it? Do you think was there any particular reason?
It's probably
risk
averse and stuff, you know.
It's just shelf space. Shelf space in retailers is an absolute premium. And especially given, you know, if you look at the last few years, I don't think anybody's under any illusions that it has been tough. It's been tough on pricing, tough on customers.
Yeah.
You know. And, you know, again, it's not somewhere I want to tread, really, but I think you've got to think about the Doctor Who brand. I mean, whatever you say, Doctor Who is front and center in the last year, purely and simply because Russell T. Davis basically has a completely innate understanding of brand and product and what gets bumped.
I think it was really telling, Al. I don't know if you've seen the documentary on him.
I saw that.
And just when he was showing Alan Yentob round his house and there's got a massive floor to ceiling shelf that has nothing but character options.
Pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah.
I was just saying, we've got a question here from from David Isn't Dead. David Isn't Dead, who would like to know if you listen. If you would like, so David Isn't Dead would like to know if you listen to the feedback people give online and the request for things. I think I know the answer to this, but you know, but to both of you, really. So do you listen to it? Does it kind of go in? Do you overact on it? Do you think that's just bollocks? Or
what's weird
something
is
there.
That on the forums, people are generally, I would say, quite kind. And as an example, having been to the BFI this weekend, people just come up and say, you know, that's a lovely figure, the future doctor, lovely figure. You made my week, whatever. Absolutely brilliant. You go on YouTube and it's just...
Oh, yeah.
that's where you've gone wrong.
Yeah.
Video after video after video.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
Why what you've done is wrong, that your company is terrible because 4,000 of you tried to order the same thing at the same time and the ordering system fell over, that... You've made the Daleks worse, not better. It was interesting because I was thinking about this the other day, I'll be very honest. I actually have been quite down recently about Doctor Who and the effect it has on me. and I'm not looking for a sympathy vote, by the way, but especially when The Fugitive came out, and I was quietly quite proud of that product. Mm. And then you go online and literally everything is vitriolic, and you just kind of go,
yeah,
God, well, I'm not sure this is worth it. Mm. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I've always said the same thing. Doctor Who has never brought me any joy or happiness, and I genuinely mean that. It's never, which is why I think I err to the side of, the classic stuff more than the modern stuff. But it really hasn't. It's, it seems like nothing you do makes anyone happy. One of my best. I've got a friend up in Inverness, and she's actually quite entertaining. And she said something very profound. So I'll mention her. So it was Deborah, up in Inverness. She had the best statement ever. She sent me a thing. She'd replied to somebody on Twitter, and she basically said, at this point, it feels like character options could turn up at your house, cook you a lovely lasagna, and you'd still moan that the cheese was wrong. that's what it feels like. You do stuff and you raise your head and somebody kicks you in the teeth because they don't like the Dalek eye.
Do you know?
It's interesting for me because weirdly enough, it's a sort of creatively satisfying centre of my universe.
Mm.
Because all the other work that I do, I'm spectacularly good at making cutesy characters and you know, sort of sweet things. But that's work. I mean, I have a vocation. I'm incredibly lucky. Doing what I do I don't think I could be successful at it if I wasn't able to be empathetic about almost every license, you know, from Teletubbies to Disney to whatever it is. You have to have a mindset where you're able to find the love. I suppose it's a bit like being an actor, really. It's like you can't say, I'm not going to play that part because it's a despicable person who's nothing like me.
And you're a bit like with my work, you know, I have to find my interest in everything and understand what it is that the client needs and what I can do to benefit them. And you still find what's interesting about that, and you know, so,
from a creative
kind of like
part,
you say, the subject matter may not be, you know, an interest of mine, but I find it, like Paul, exactly like you just said, how I can make it appeal to me and therefore give it my best.
You shoot
to,
it like James Cameron would, something like that.
Yeah, I would,
you
know? Yeah. Blue lasers,
blue lasers,
smoke,
yeah, yeah.
Know, explosions, winner.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, that's a very good observation, and I say that, or have said it to people in our place in the past, which is, because it seems to be a modern phenomenon where people sort of go, oh, you know, I can't really work on this because I can't really, my head's not in it. You know,
doesn't
my head's
speak
not
to me.
There, and it's not, it's not, you know, it's not my thing.
I can't find my news.
I never got that fucking choice, to be honest. You work on.
Yeah.
Everything, and I work on stuff that doesn't always float my boat. But like you guys, you find something that you kind of go, oh, maybe we can do this, and that's our jobs as creatives is to kind of find the one thing that kind of goes, oh, there's a different way of doing this. We could do
but
it.
For me, the thing that sort of is the reward, the thing that I find most artistically satisfying. And in fact, in terms of making money, like doing likenesses does not make me money because I'll spend way over the amount of time that is
you know
you're getting paid for. Every job has a perceived value, and you're never going to get. It doesn't matter what you put into it. You're never going to get more than that perceived value, and I will always, you know, put my absolute utmost into doing likenesses, and because I find, you know, it's so satisfying to create the impression of a person and have people be able to recognise it.
And
it's
also
also crashing
on the other side.
Well, it is, and what I was going to say to that is, I almost feel like we've been doing Ed a disservice for all these years, because, as everybody probably knows, we've been experimenting with moulding in colour rather than painting on a lot of the figures. And actually, I'm going back to have a look at some of the previous figures we've done. One thing we're talking about is potentially creating a sort of vortex series of figures where we'll go back to all the Doctors and revisit them in a more black series, highly detailed kind of way. That'll get the internet talking. I'm sure there'll be complaints though. But we've almost—I almost feel like we've done a disservice, because it's quite startling when you mould these figures that Ed has been involved with, going back over literally almost two decades, and you run them without any paint, literally a bare sculpt. It's a astounding the level of detail that you get compared with ones that have had the paint slapped on. Yeah. You know, the Colin Baker one was a perfect example. We did that for B&M just because I was kind of like, it looks crap. Just let's run it and do it this way, the way we sort of started to do stuff. It looks brilliant. Mm. I can't wait, literally can't wait to see what some of these figures look like when they're run in plastic with no paint, because I think it will blow people's socks off when they actually see the level of detail.
Despite everything, then, despite some of the vitriol online, despite the negativity that we all see, there still seems to be that excitement for the new thing that you know is coming up.
And could I just like to say as well, it's sort of saddens me, Al, to hear you say that you feel like that, and but I understand where you're coming from, because you know, you both of you, but you put so much into all of this, and you do love it, and then the internet just seems to be where people go to hate on stuff, and you know, we've had a little bit, haven't we, Paul, for some stuff we've done, and you go on YouTube and it's, this is a failure, this is a disaster, this is blah blah blah, and you know, it's just everywhere, and I think sometimes people forget that
there's people on the other side of that.
There's a person. It doesn't matter whether they're, someone on TV, or you know, playing at Wembley Stadium, or you know, writing a book or whatever. It's, do you know what I mean? We're all people, and it seems so easy to criticise and kind of.
I think you're right. It seems to be some. It seems to be some platforms more than others. I mean, I would say probably the good things outweigh the bad, but it's cumulative. It kind of drip.
That's the hard thing
drip,
to do.
Drip, drip, gets.
And the good things, you know, you end up focusing on the bad stuff more. And also, we've both noticed that people are quicker to trash stuff, and that's a louder kind of chunk of the audience. And the people who do like something or are positive about it, they don't say anything because they're probably afraid of the roasting they'll get.
As you guys probably know, you know, it's all, I'm all for people having their say. Mm. You know, I would, you know, that's, we live in a democracy and we have freedom of speech, but some of these people are talentless hacks. and they gun you for everything, and you just think, you know, fair enough, fair on you. You know, you get a chance to have your say, but you know, I've seen your YouTube videos, and you can't even spray something using a rattle can, and you're costing me back.
Yeah, that's my the thing. I kind of think
everyone's an expert, aren't they?
Everyone's an expert. Put your money everyone where your mouth is, and you know, and it's easy to criticise and make that the default, and but also often do it from a place without an understanding behind things as well. You know, so they,
well, that's why I think it must be difficult for yourselves and the likes of the people that make Doctor Who. I mean, it must be. Like I say, as far as I'm aware, everywhere on the planet has that's been involved in Doctor Who behind the scenes or making product, literally, they care like next level. They care. They do stuff that they don't get paid for. Ed said it there. Yeah. You know, I do stuff that I don't get. You know, it's not that I don't get paid for it, but I do stuff above and beyond to try and make it good. Mm. You guys make films, and like you say, sometimes it's not the stuff that floats your boat, but you do the best thing. And things like this stuff that you guys do is over and above, and everyone there goes over and above. And I don't think there's any doubt that people absolutely, you know, put their heart and soul into stuff. But as you say, it's you can, in 5 minutes you can tear somebody down, because if the first review you see on anything is somebody, you know, it's like Amazon reviews, isn't it? You kind of go on, this is marvelous, this arrived in pieces, I'm never buying from these people again. You can't win, but we keep trying.
You know, somewhere out there, you know, there are good people, and I think, like you said, Jeff, they don't always speak up, but you know, if we give them the environments where they can speak up and they can feel confident about saying what they love rather than what they hate, and we do see that starting to happen, you know, I was gonna say
that for us, I think they express their love for the work in a slightly different way. They might not go online and say, I think this is the most amazing thing in the whole world, but they will go on Instagram and take the most beautiful photographs.
One of the things I was going to say pertinent to Ed was that they almost inevitably, because Ed literally sort of 5 minutes before everything releases, Ed goes, can I put it on my website? And I'm like, yeah, sure. And no problem at all. So they basically, the first thing they do is they go, what the fuck is this? And then they go to Ed's website and they go, this is marvelous. How did they cock it up? you've got this weird counterpoint, which is why I moving to this non-painted version, which a lot of people don't like, but I'm gradually trying to educate and kind of, I'm not going back from it. But if you can showcase somebody's work like Ed's, you know, and you can showcase it in a better way and it makes a better product and people can kind of see the level of detail that you have put into something.
Indeed.
That's always going to be a good thing. So
yeah, when you showed us some pictures, Ed, you know, the detail is phenomenal. You know, and you know, little heads, you know, the clown, you've got your toothpick there and stuff. It's and you know.
So when we were offline last time, Al,
What the hell did you say?
I wasn't really recording anything.
I played a little game with the archive, and I said, name a figure, and they named a figure, and I could pull up the photos that I took of the original prototypes.
Yes.
You know, that's that. However many ridiculous number of hundreds of thousands of images.
That's what we were talking about, wasn't it? Yeah.
Going over the 20 years and that, just while I was looking around, I found you know, as a do, I just, things I'd forgotten that I'd done, a whole folder full of imagery of Andrew Teal sculpting the first and second Doctor, like all the way through the process that I'd recorded, so you can see the body you know, being built up with the layers of clothing around it. And
tell you guys, you need to put this on a coffee table book. You know, this has to.
Well, that's why it came about.
I've upset a few people recently because there's quite a few people want to put an action figure book together, and maybe it's something we can work with you guys on. But there's quite a few people that want to do it, and I was, my initial reaction was yes, but then my next reaction was actually, Ed and I's feelings on this are probably more aligned, which is we have a slightly, because we're on the other side, we're, we have a slightly more visceral, if that's the right word, probably isn't, kind of feeling about some of these figures and how they got from A to B. So we kind of want to do our thing and kind of tell the story from our side. But yeah, it would be great.
We did have a chat about that, didn't we, Ed? And like you were saying, Ed, there are people who do wonderful, you know, figure photography, and that, and that's how they show their love. Yeah. And, you know, the other day I think I tweeted a picture of the Fugitive with Jodie in front of the TARDIS, kind of, and I put a little bit of lens flare and stuff on it, you know. And I said, is it too late to get into figure photography? Asking for a friend, you know, it's me. It got a really good response on on Twitter and Instagram. And I thought there was
I don't know if it's still going, but there used to be a weekly Instagram mini competition that someone ran to take photos that looked like old episodes.
Oh, okay. So
there's a guy, I think he's called...
They would treat, give them a treat.
Yeah.
There's
a chap called George, I think he's George Cairns. He does his pictures like that. You know, they're very, very stylized. And the one I did was just kind of a white wall. It was very simple. And I did get a bit of a boost a couple of years ago. You know, Hot Toys, they ran a competition, take a picture of your figure, I think it was anyone, or of your Spider-Man, and some prices. So I thought,
sort of Hot Toys, you know, getting
worried. None of your type, you know. And I took a picture of my Spidey with Doctor Strange.
Is that what they call it, Jeff?
Out on Twitter, on Instagram. Anyway, I won one of the prizes, so I was like, you can say I'm an award-winning photographer now of figures.
prize-winning.
Ed used to do astounding photography because it would start off perfectly sensible, and by the end of it, you'd have a pile of dead Cybermen with somebody standing on top of it with a massive Reaper gun looking like this. Just mowed down the entire squad.
So reenacting the Battle of Voga or something.
Some of the photography is cool, isn't it? I mean, you did quite a lot of that stuff. I think that's the weird thing, isn't it? I mean, nowadays we do everything digitally, and Ed and I go along and we scan somebody, and then I say, "How long?" And he says, 2 weeks. And then you get it back. But in the old days, it was literally a sculpt, and I'd turn up and it might be sort of in transition. You'd have like half of it done and half of it not done. And they never used to want me to hold anything because my ability to break stuff was unparalleled. Ed would quite often hand me something and go, "Oh, it's quite delicate." And then it'd be like, "Ting,
sausage fingers."
And the right legs, arms,
But I love that, you know, despite the fact that it's a big business, so there was a quote that was about Disney back in the day, and Marvel Comics, and how it's the world's biggest mom and pop business, because essentially it comes down to pencil and paper, you know, to do it.
Mom and pop.
And what you guys do is, you know, and that's not being dismissive of it at all, but it's people crafting and making stuff, and it's, you know, it's just one person, you know, making that figure and one person doing that. And I think it's, you know, it's amazing, really, the work that goes into it all, and that creativity, and the small, you know, pool of talent that do it all.
Well, I think it's...
Well, we have to keep going, because there's still three Doctors that I haven't done. So.
There you go.
I think sometimes we don't stop to sort of think what has been done, and Ed's, Ed and I are pretty much aligned on a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember a lot of times I'd come in and he'd say, "This is the whatever," and I'd go, "I'm not sure." And he'd go, "I knew you'd say that," and he'd just literally go off. There was never any kind of
I
don't think he would ever fight.
I would never question Al if he thought something needed needed tweaking. I'd absolutely take it. But that's another part of it. That thing about the saying about the satisfaction of doing a likeness.
Yeah.
You have to be open to that, because sometimes you don't quite see it in the right way, or you see it in a particular way. You have to be open to appreciating what you've done and being able to have the humility to go back and look at it in a different way. And I mean, a lot of those things, I think with likenesses particularly, it's not that I wouldn't have got the likeness right, it's that I've I might have picked a particular look
that wasn't
the best look. And so you know, you go, it is really tricky when you're looking at them, because some of the characters, the reference materials that you've got are not extensive, so you don't have the luxury of having the character from lots of different angles pulling the same expression. So there's always this sort of tension with the older figures, because you really, you want to nail that character. And
it's bizarrely quite difficult to be as subjective with a digital turnaround than it is with, I find, than it used to be with the physical sculpt. Because with the physical sculpt, you'd kind of hold it in your hand and you'd go, yeah, it's cool. And actually, a lot of the time, what the problem was you'd go, that's bloody brilliant. And then you'd blow it up to send it in for submission. And it's like blowing up a match head. And Ed always said, you know, I'd say, oh, dude, it looks a bit gammy. And Ed would be like, fuck's sake, Al, that's like 400% bigger than it actually is in real life.
It's not going to be that big.
Like...
I was kind of having this discussion, because nowadays you look at my renders and they're looking at the head on their HD monitor at 1:1 size, an object which will be 15 millimeters tall in production. In those days, it was the opposite problem, in that when you held it in your hands as a 15 millimeter object, you could instantly see the likeness and feel that was really good. But submitting it, I have to photograph it with a 35mm macro lens camera, and then they are looking at it on a monitor
size of a house
at 1:1 scale. And it does not translate.
No, and that still happens today. We get numerous, and not just on Doctor Who, we get numerous occasions where we send in CAD for approval and they kind of go, oh, that's not right and that's not right. And you kind of go, well, the problem is that when the CAD's rendered, it's rendered, I don't know the terminology, but you get a flat on view. In reality, you never get a flat on view. So nobody is ever flat on. Because my feet are going down, my head's going up, my shoulders are above your eye line, you're sort of wherever you're aiming. So you get a twisted kind of perception, whereas something that's sitting in your hand, you kind of go, actually, that's bang on.
It's more alive, isn't it?
I mean, the Fugitive Doctor is quite interesting. I don't know if Ed fully knows the story of the... of the head debacle, which I can go into for you if you want, but it was we discovered, and actually, again, I'm apologising to Ed because he'll be like, well, that makes sense. we had a sort of weird issue that started to happen. I'll jump back even further than that. Previous, we'd always used the same tooling company in Hong Kong. They used to make the tooling models, and then they would make the tooling, and they were fantastic guys, and they were absolutely brilliant. But as that company aged and went on, it kind of got less and less. And they still did the tooling, but they didn't do a lot of the in-between bits. And so fast forward to us getting a lot of the digital heads that we've done recently, and we started to get this weird phenomenon where... scale would be a little bit off, and some of the features that Ed had kind of put in were significantly different. And I kept saying, oh, this is bloody weird. You know, it looks perfect on paper, but what I'm getting out the other end is
just not right. Yeah.
Bloody awful. And and in the old days, that used to a lot, that quite often used to happen with them when they polished the tool, because what they would do is they would burn out the tool, but then to mold it they want to get rid of all the carbon and stuff, so they polish it out with and if they over polish it, it knocks the detail. You literally polish the details out, so it makes the tool what comes out the tool feel like that tool is about 20 years old, because everything's soft. So you used to call it like soft tooling, and you know, you'd say, no, I'm not paying for that, redo it, kind of thing. But we'd had a couple of issues on a couple of figures with that. And then we got the Fugitive Doctor head, and we were in this weird situation where they did the tooling and they sent me, which is one of the reasons. So the Fugitive Doctor was done ages ago. I mean, Ed will tell you, we scanned him. Say it's all him and his talent, but we did it ages ago. But what happened was, we made the tools, ran the tools, and I kept getting these shots coming through, and I was like, this looks dreadful, you know, like it properly looks not good. And they were like, oh yeah, it's a flow issue, we can fix it. And I said, well, fine, fix it and send it back to me. So then they'd do more tests, and then 2 weeks later it would come in, and it still didn't look good. And then I was like, well, look, get the tool maker to come to the factory and run the tools the way they think it needs to be done. So you can... And they kept saying, no, the tools are fine, it's the shot, you know, it's the shot rate and everything. It wasn't going through the tool fast enough. Eventually it just got to the point where I was like, this is shit. And every time you tell me it's going to be great, I keep getting the same thing through, and it's absolutely crap. So actually the whole head of the Fugitive Doctor was completely remade from scratch, because I just basically said, I'm rejecting this and I'm not having it. Because I was quite keen that the first Doctor of Colour that we produced should not look crap. I mean, over and above the fact I wanted her to look brilliant and the scan was brilliant, I just didn't want a crap action figure, and it just it was awful. I've still got some of the shots and stuff. But so that was completely remade. But what they found was that there was an issue. So there was an issue in the translation of Ed's very high res file to the point where they were making, and nobody had picked up on it. So they were making the tooling model, which is the sort of ceramic based high-end print that they then used to make the electrode that burns into the tool. So they were making that from, but somewhere in there, Ed's very high-end, lovely print was having the polygon count reduced massively, and it just looked awful.
So,
but what we realised was actually that had affected a couple of figures previously to that as well. Most specifically, I would say the Harry Sullivan. Which never came out the way it actually looked. On paper, it looked amazing, and in reality, it didn't. Maybe that, a bit of Ian Chesterton.
That issue, it's the thing. So they used a system that we used to use at DesignWorks, Freeform.
Yeah.
Which it defines 3D. Using voxels, which are effectively three-dimensional pixels. So every object in the CAD is made of little cubes. And just like a JPEG image, the smaller the cubes, the higher the resolution. Now I know this from my experience. So I sculpt in ZBrush, which is a polygon based system. When you take a polygon model into a voxel based system, it's kind of like it treats that model as a container and it fills it up with cubes. Now if you set your resolution right and you're filling it up with tiny cubes, you get no loss of detail. But if you want to do it a little bit quickly, it
puts noise in there
because it takes exponentially longer to calculate the smaller blocks when translating, and pressed for time tooling company might not have that time, then they'll put the clay coarseness up and automatically you've lost
detail.
I noticed it when I got back CAD from the Far East. Occasionally would do post tool amendments for different reasons, and the first time I really noticed it was on the Fourth Doctor's Balmoral hat.
It's got a little
badge on it with a plume of feathers, and the badge has a Latin motto on, which I spent the nth degree to find out exactly what that badge was, and it was actually a pipe band badge.
Right.
So it's they obviously just found that Balmoral in a shop somewhere, and they got that. But that badge was from pipe band, and it had a Latin motto on it, and I put that in, and the when I looked at this CAD, the entire thing was
it's gone
missing.
Really?
Yeah.
The shape was there. And actually, you know, most people wouldn't know. That.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I just thought, yeah.
And so that had happened because that company was no longer doing the whole process. It was taking the end result of a third party doing the process. Right. And it took a bit of finding out what exactly had gone wrong. But now that we have found out what went wrong, we've sort of solved it. And the fugitive was definitely one where that was not good.
So that
was part of the delay of her coming out.
I don't have a fugitive in hand, but I've been looking at other people's photographs.
Have I not sent you one?
Mine's upstairs.
I just cast that bait out.
Reel them in.
Real example in.
Excuse me.
But the thing that really excited me looking at that is that you can see the I really wanted to get to represent her as she's such an awesome human being, such a brilliant character, standout character.
She's still in the box, mate. There you go. There she is. It's lovely.
But when you look at the hair, it's the detail of the twist.
You're not helping, Paul.
Not really. You can see.
I can't believe you didn't open it.
I will.
Yeah, I noticed the hair. It's been really detailed.
No, but I mean, Ed's right, because the level of detail on that character when they did get it right was astounding, which again was why, again, it's that disheartening thing of you go on YouTube and they're like, they're cost-cutting again. They're not painting the faces. And it's like, fuck's sake, there's a reason why we haven't done that. You know, we've sort of finally realised that we can do the flesh better and do an overspray and do the details, and it'll look much better and it'll have more details and you'll have a much better action figure.
Yeah,
go ahead and complain.
I'm so surprised that anyone would give that response, because that is something I have seen real positive reactions to.
There was a couple of people that were quite negative about it because it didn't match the rest of their collection, so they felt aggrieved.
There's always a few.
Modernised it.
Yeah.
So we should never do better articulation.
We should never do better articulation. We should never do more layered clothing.
Yeah. In fact, you should go back to.
It's important not to have mobile shoulder joints.
Just the arms.
We should do them all disco dancing.
Yeah.
Hey, disco dancing doctor range. Now that's something I'd pay a dollar for. That's for sure.
Yeah. Now that is a limited edition. There,
there you go. Exactly.
Shiny suit variation.
Disco doctor.
Glitter,
Bring it on. I'd have some of that. It's always easy to to see only the bad stuff. And it, like we said earlier, it's easy for people to kind of put criticisms on there and everything else. But genuinely, I think there is a lot of love and appreciation for what you guys do.
Should I ask you guys some quick fire questions?
Yes, go on. Let's do quick fire.
Okay. So, are there any plans to make the figures more available worldwide? Did I see something that, that Diamond might have picked up distribution in the US?
I can't 100% comment on that yet, but straight up answer to that is yes. You will see a significant difference this year. And again, it's all tied to the fact that Doctor Who is quietly bubbling and the heat's turning up and everything's getting, and the interest levels are going through the roof. So the honest answer is, yeah, 100% you're going to see, and I can't give you the specifics, but yeah, you're going to see some different distribution channels. And for stuff that maybe you wouldn't have thought you'd be able to get. So, yeah, that's definitely happening. Okay.
Oh, good. Well, that'll please people.
Indeed.
Kieran Kavanagh on Twitter asks if you've ever worked on a Valyard figure.
Valyard.
If not, Valyard. Excuse my inability to talk properly. That figure. And if you would do one.
No. I've never worked on a Valyard figure.
Oh,
Ed's never worked on a Valyard figure. And Michael Jason passed away the other day,
which is probably why he's
asking. No, we've had a few figures we've worked on. I mean, we've got a very nice Eric Roberts head kicking around somewhere, which is rather spesh.
Just looking for something to dress for the occasion.
Have never made it out and various other things. But no, the Valyard, no, hasn't been on there.
Okay. Rob White asks for some info on the Mutt digital prototype.
So the Mutt digital prototype, the honest answer on that one is I don't think it'll ever get released. In fact, I actually gave somebody the CAD for that the other day so they could do a print of it, and probably reasonably happy to let that go public domain, because I just can't see it being a figure that we'd make as an action figure. It was done, but it was done at that time where there was a chance to kind of potentially make stuff, classic series stuff. But again, it's one of those ones that in hindsight you kind of think, was it a terrific story? Was it a particularly memorable? I mean, I'd say the Mutt's more memorable from its dismembered appearance in the Brain of Morbius than it is from the actual episode that it appeared in.
Yeah.
Like, I'm quite happy to make that one available. I mean, you'd have to print it yourself and make it, but I'm quite happy to make that one available, because I'm 110% sure that we'll never make it.
Oh, well, never mind.
Next quickfire question.
Any update on the Emperor Dalek being re-released after the mold was found?
Rediscovered.
Any update on the Emperor Dalek?
The
Emperor Dalek prototype that turned up on eBay that was nothing to do with us. yes. There is an update on that, which is you're just going to have to wait and see.
He's teasing us.
I'm caught between a rock and a hard place on this one, because if I deny or confirm it, all I say is just wait and see and put 15 quid in the bank quietly, and you might be able to spend it later in the year.
Any more classic companions coming? There's another one.
No.
Oh, that was quick, wasn't it?
No. What's happened is that the sort of upsurge in new series stuff has almost certainly turned the tide a little bit in terms of the sort of development that we will be aiming towards. And I think it's fairly safe to say at this point that we'll probably be looking more new series than classic for a short period of time.
Yeah.
That said, I think, you know, some stuff's been sculpted previously. There was a Liz Shaw figure. I think people are aware that one was done But so she's there. She's waiting.
Just waiting for the day.
She looks astounding. She looks fabulous. That's a brilliant figure. That's one of Ed's absolute barnstormers of a figure.
I loved sculpting.
What story did you take her from, can we ask?
Well, it was a mixed bag. So I threw Ed a complete curveball and said, I said, basically, take Dr. Constantine and make him into a Primord, the sort of the head guy, which he did. I said, we'd have potentially the third Doctor with a younger head, like a Series 7 head. And we'd have a Liz Shaw. Mm. And you would think, well, you take Liz Shaw from Inferno with a Primord, but actually it doesn't quite line up. So it was basically a Series 7 set that was imagined. So I have got a Pertwee with a younger head, which looks brilliant.
Wow.
In fact, I've got shots of that first head, but you ain't going to get it for a long
time.
I
was getting so excited.
And that's a little scoop for you. I've got it, but you can't have it. Don't bother writing to anyone. They're not getting it. Because if it does come out, it will come
another
out.
Another one of my best ever scores. There.
It was absolutely, it is absolutely beautiful. And the Liz Shaw that we ended up with two, didn't we? And the one that I particularly liked was the one from the Silurians, the red dress.
Yeah.
So she would be absolutely, because I think she's an under, you know, if
yeah, you know, if she, I had yeah, she was only in one season, wasn't she, and made a huge impact.
But, you know, she was brilliant, and I think it's sad that they kind of got rid of her because she was clever. That's the sort of thing that would make the Daily Mail nowadays.
It would.
Doctor Who companion's too clever. She's got to be dumbed down. You know, it's like, you know,
Doctor Who companion has more brains than the Doctor.
I've always said, oh yeah, I'm a massive fan of the Big Finish guys, and they've done a couple of brilliant stories with Liz Shaw in it, including one with a Primord, bizarrely enough, or the Primords. But I think an Inferno.
That's got to be
Inferno. What a story! I mean, what
it's brilliant. I love it. You could do at least two sets with that, because you can have the alternate Earth set as well, where they're all dressed up in fascistic gear.
It was just crazy good, and you kind of think, my God, how many episodes are they mental? And you just sit and you watch it all.
Seven
and you're
episodes.
My God, this is just brilliant.
It is.
So yes, that set was a complete mixed bag. So it was Liz Shaw, and I think what was the other one we did, Ed? Because it was a Liz Shaw from in the blue dress from with the
with
sort
the
of
hat.
More.
The red the
was
the
that
red
the Inferno blue, one with the blue dress?
Yeah, blue was look it up now. Blue was with the blonde hair and
anyway, blue dress, anyway. Shoulder length, sort of hair out.
Yeah,
but gotcha. the one that I absolutely just think is out of this world is her Silurian outfit. Mm. I mean, she just looks absolutely gorgeous. So that set, hopefully at some point in the future.
Okay, well, I'll hope for that one. Yeah. Definitely.
Never say never. That's what I say. Okay. Never say never.
Are there any plans for? The question says past era figures not yet made, but they're talking more about the 12th and 13th Doctor's eras.
I would say sort of not.
It's going to favour the current series, presumably, with all of that stuff, right?
Not that it's necessarily too close. I just, I think I've always, you know, we've always had to kind of by hook or by crook do bits and bobs to make figures, and I've always said the same thing, which is classic figures in a lot of cases are easier to do because in a lot of cases they're wearing boiler suits or they're wearing lab coats or they're wearing stuff that's relatively easy to adapt. A lot of the new series stuff is very, very specific.
Ambassadors of Death.
Ambassadors of Death. Story. Yeah.
Oh my God! I was at BFI the other day, and a very nice chap came up to me and showed me his sculpt that he'd done of the ambassadors, and I think he commissioned it, but bloody hell, it looked good. But did yeah, it? Ambassadors really? Of Death, really good, yeah. Really good.
It's one of my favorite again,
that's
stories,
another story. It's like that. It's that. Mm. I mean, that's kind of Ambassadors for me is a little bit like the Vashtar Narada. You know, it's scary ass guys in spacesuits.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, that's the one where Caroline John's wearing the hat and the boots, isn't it? And the short
The Krulls are another monster that I just Krulls. Think of.
Android Invasion. Yeah, that's got to be. Yeah, and that's say it again.
I mean, the ultimate set for me would be Fourth Doctor, Android Zero with the face that matches the pod that they fire off, which is just still to this day scares the life out of me. Yeah. That thing, and then. Spigaron and Chidaki basically as a twin. It's just like, wow.
It kind of makes itself, doesn't it, really?
It does, yeah. Some stories you just kind of go, well,
You just see it, yeah, that's it, exactly that. And Sarah Jane with a removable face to reveal the android interior.
Yeah, the old googly eyes. The
googly eyes,
Next question, caller.
When I was a kid.
Right, I've a feeling my battery's I'm down to 18%.
We're going to wrap it up pretty quickly.
I'm just going to remind you quickly that Weeping Angel 13th, I mean, it's a must, surely. Okay? Even if it's just a one-off for me, all right?
I'll do that. I'll do that for you.
There you go.
Okay, I'll do that forever if you do that.
I'll find a way by hook or by crook. It might have some milliput stuck around the neck where I've glued it up on for you.
There you go, Jeff. There's your bloody Weeping Angel 13. Now, shut up about it.
This came from multiple people, I think. Will the Yeti ever appear?
God, I hope so. I talked about that in a different podcast about the irony of the Yeti. The irony of the Yeti is we were told to stick clear of it and not to go near it because the Haseman Lincoln estate were not best friends with the BBC. Mm. And I, being a pain in the arse, I basically said, I'm going to go and chat to them. Is that okay? And I got in touch with Henry Lincoln, and there was various wranglings, and he sort of said, if you can use it, it's no problem. So this is interesting because this is towards the end of the underground thing that we started off the whole conversation with, but it was one of the last ones, and I could never quite get it over the line, but eventually I did get clearance because the BBC basically gave up and said, do what the hell you want. Henry Lincoln basically said, if you're just doing it as an action figure, I'll write you a thing that says you can do it as an action figure. It's fine. Just do it. Do what you want. And I literally got permission. And then the whole thing sort of fell apart and we never got to do it. It's one of those ones. Everybody wants it. And I kind of get it. I do kind of get it 100%. But it wouldn't do a lot if you look at the... Yeah. Yeti in terms of
it would enable people to recreate the snowy Himalayan scene of the Yeti invading the monastery stuff with their photographs.
Where I really wanted to be was to have a Yeti that you could essentially change so that you could have both variants, the sort of web one and somehow
an original,
change it and have the Himalayan one.
Yeah,
which is my preferred one.
And you can have a removable belly, like a Teletubby or something, where you put the great intelligence spheres into.
Yeah,
that there you go. So,
that was the other thing I toyed with was could I do it in fabric? You know, with a face stuck on the front of it. But I'm not sure. I mean, having touted this marvelous sculpt around several conventions to then go, I've made it into a Furby. I think, you know, if ever they were going to come at me with torches and pitchforks, that's the sort of Aldur found dead, strung up, burning to a lamppost because he released a Furby. You know, basically. So,
enraged Yeti fan explains, it wasn't my fault. Exactly.
The answer to that is who sculpted the Yeti, Ed?
That was Andrew Teal.
It was Andrew. Yeah. So, The answer is, yeah, I'd love to. I mean, there's a ton of stuff I'd love to do. I'd absolutely love to do. But yeah. Next question.
I got two questions for you, because I'm aware time is getting
on. Yeah, I'll shoot in a minute.
This is sort of the Furby thing made me think of this. A few people asked if there might ever be a Carvanista figure, or would he be a total nightmare to sculpt?
Don't think sculpting would be an issue. Again, it's back to the previous question. It's from that sort of previous era. So I would say it's like almost everything, as I say, our focus is probably forwards at the moment rather than backwards.
But maybe one day.
Yeah, maybe one day. As I say, looking forwards, definitely, and it's not the kind of figure you could do for B&M.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Never know. Carvanista might come back in the series anyway, and play a prominent role. You never know with these things, do you?
Never know.
You just never know. Never say never. That's what I say. Always be positive.
Last question then, and I can probably guess the answer here, but can you share anything exclusive with us at the moment?
No.
For our audio listeners, Al took a very long, lingering look around at something as if to suggest that there might be, and then dropped that one on us.
I genuinely was thinking hard about that, but the honest answer is, no, there is definitely some cool stuff coming.
But just not quite.
But you're just gonna have to wait.
No.
Did we cover everything we wanted to on the fugitive? And
I think so. We we chatted obviously when we were together, Al, and Ed. We had a bit of a chat about it in our other episode, didn't we? And I think fugitive is nicely covered. It's beautiful. Very interesting talking about other things that are.
I thought the interesting thing was the gun. You know, we've never had a doctor that's gone with a gun before, and I actually went back to DVT and said, "Is a gun right?" And they said, "Do the gun." And I went, "Fine, we'll do the gun."
Yeah, I did see some chatter about that online actually, where there's some people felt it'd be better if it was her. She didn't have a Sonic, did she? But she had something else. What does she have?
Yeah,
I think the issue was it was a Division blaster, and it was taken off her and it backfired and killed the person. But it's still a slightly odd one to have a doctor with a gun, I thought.
But then it's the fugitive doctor, and you know, that's
She was a bit more. Yeah,
so where do you guys fall in the thing of, is she from pre-Hartnell or is she somewhere between 2 and 3? Because the theory was originally that somewhere between 2 and 3, that after the war games, that the Division takes the Doctor and
6.5
dump him on Earth.
I like to think that she was before Hartnell, probably with some other doctors as well, but all of those memories and stuff have been erased, and the doctor doesn't remember any of it.
That's trauma.
Put silence everywhere.
No, it's fine. I love the idea of her being pre-Hartnell, or you know, way back, and I think that's probably what she is, given the whole history of the Division and stuff like that. But the only thing that kind of jars against that is why don't she have a police box TARDIS? Because it was the first Doctor who kind of realised that it's stuck in the shape of a police box. So, but I still love the mystery of it. You know, and I love the fact that these things aren't easily answered, you know, because that's one of the big attractions for Doctor Who, is the whole mystery of so many different, so many things that either contradict or don't make sense, or that we will never know. You know, and I love all that.
Well, there's the whole Morbius thing.
Exactly, that's it, part of it. Yes.
If you buy into that. Which it's a bit like Deckard being an android. He's not an android. I don't care what you tell me. I'm never buying.
We talked about this on a podcast just about to go out actually, because I was listening to it today. One that we did on Ask Us Anything.
We did talk about
Blade Runner quite a bit. But Ridley Scott says in all his talks when he talks about the film, he has no doubt that Deckard is a replicant, but it's not explained in the
Harrison
film.
Harrison Ford is no doubt.
And Harrison,
no,
exactly. Harrison but Ford says he's not. Yeah. But there's a cut scene where Deckard sees his wife drive past at some point.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to sort of, there was supposed to be more backstory that kind of filled it in, but I don't get it.
But that's the thing, isn't it? It's like the film itself doesn't answer the question. So regardless of what the director says or the actor say or everything, if you just take the film as it stands on its own, there's no wrong or right. So it's open to your own interpretation and your own feelings towards it. And for me, that always makes me want to go back and watch it again to look for different clues, for another idea. Or it just keeps the thing alive, those asking those questions, keeping that mystery. And it's the same with Doctor Who as well. Yeah, that's one of the big reasons why I still watch it.
Yeah. You know,
it's always changing itself.
It's one of the reasons that I really like 2049, because he managed to craft something amazing that also didn't answer that question.
I know, it's brilliant.
It's the only fact is that there was they had a child, but
it's still not really answered, is it? You know,
there's no answer. No. That's not answered.
Because actually, is she his daughter or is she not really? You know, because for all through the film, it's you know, Kay's convinced that he's the child, and then and all his memories tell him that he is. But of course, his memories aren't real, right? But their experiences, though, they're real, which makes them real. But...
Well, that's the bit that I think is interesting about the Deckard thing, which is if you can implant memories into a humanoid, why couldn't you extract them or put them, you know, because things like the unicorn going through the forest, you know, that doesn't necessarily equate to him having his memories, you know.
No, but it means that somebody else knows what his memories are, because Edward James Olmos's character creates a little origami unicorn, doesn't he? And just kind of leaves it as if to say, I know, you know, what you don't know. Kind of thing,
yeah.
But I think that's a retrofit because
no, it's originally shot.
They didn't, no, because that the unicorn things
it was Excalibur, wasn't it?
Yeah, was no, like... the other one with Tom Cruise,
Legend.
Legend, and the unicorn origami can equally just say, I was here, and I've let you go.
That's the whole point, isn't it? It's different interpretations. You can read it in different ways. It doesn't give you a definitive answer one way or the other, which keeps it alive, you know. So there's different ways to read just, it.
It all, more than anything, begs the question, what the hell happened to Ridley Scott? Because, my God, is he capable of making a decent
film? Don't even talk about Prometheus and Covenant.
Alien saga anymore.
But then you can level that at Spielberg as well, which is when these young buck producers that sort of, as they've aged, they've kind of hit a groove of stuff they're comfortable with, and, you know, arguably, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull is not a patch on even the later one. I mean, Dial of Destiny, whether you like it or not, and I've watched it now about 12 times. It's a flipping brilliant film. It's so well made. It's not necessarily the sort of last hurrah that you want indie to go out on, but in terms of a piece of filmmaking, it's
pretty good.
Light years ahead of Crystal Skull. Crystal Skull is the laziest ass movie they ever did about indie.
It just looks completely studio Destiny bound, doesn't it?
You know,
captures some of the old spirit of the films.
There's most of it. You know, that first 20 minutes is just fabulous.
Yeah, we do need to have a proper full-on nerd-out session, don't we? With a few beers or something at some point. We've got to do that.
Yeah, we should get together. Yeah, it would be good.
Brilliant stuff. What's that? He's reaching for something. He's got a fedora.
He's got a hat.
Look at that.
Oh.
Actually, a ringer for Terry Pratchett now. Look at that.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Look at that.
Terry Pratchett had such a lisp, didn't he?
He did. Bless him. Yeah. King Terry. We love Terry. Brilliant. Al, Ed, thank you guys so much for jumping on our podcast one more time. And as always, it's a real pleasure to have you join us and open up about some of the processes, some of the things we've seen, and you know, the personal stories as well, and the general kind of geek outness of our further discussions. So thank you, you both, very good to us, and to you guys.
I mean, I can't thank you guys enough for dropping everything and coming to do the filming that day. But I've just been admiring your shelf, Paul, behind you, and it's just insane the amount of Doctor Who. The amount of Doctor Who stuff that's on there. So
don't look behind me. I've got some washing.
Oh my god. I can see a
trash
back there.
See, I put some thought into my background.
There's some
Jeff.
Guinea pig food there. Yeah, hey, I have to, when I'm at home podcasting the conservatory, the guinea pigs are going crazy next to me because I think they're going to get.
What are the names of your? Just remind us what your girls have called your guinea pigs. What are their names?
There's Poppy and Rainbow Sparkles.
Rainbow Sparkles, that's it. Beautiful.
Well, I've got a hamster called Biscuit who's staring at me at the moment like he wants to come out desperately to play, so I might take him out.
Yeah, but Biscuit's quite a suitable name for a hamster, I think. Yeah,
it is.
Poppy's all right. Rainbow Sparkles is...
Rainbow Sparkles is pushing it, I have to be honest. I kind of expect her to be going to Abba Voyage quite soon.
Oh dear, brilliant guys, thank you so much.
Thank you both.
Have a pleasant
evening.
We'll
catch you all soon on Who Corner to Corner.
Indeed, see you next time. Thank you for listening. Thanks, Ed. Thank you for watching.
I haven't seen you for ages. We need to catch up.